We yesterday spoke about the events leading up to the 30 years war, or rather about the situation under the 30 years war. That is, it's Roman numeral 6 for the 17th century, B for the first half of the century on the continent, 3 for the 30 years war, and under that, A, the situation in 1600. And under A, number 4, we mentioned the Habsburgs, these rulers who had now had a ruler in Spain and a ruler in Austria. And while together they did not have as much area as Charles V had had, yet they had nearly as much because of a new accession to it. Ferdinand I, the brother of Charles V, you remember, had been made Archduke of Austria by his brother, while Charles was emperor over the whole empire. And Frederick had married a woman who was the heiress, who was the sister of the King of Bohemia. And when the king died, Frederick Ferdinand had claimed the right to succeed him through his wife, succeed his brother-in-law, and had succeeded in becoming elected King of Bohemia with the condition that he should respect the rights, the local rights of the people. Now, you all, I trust, are well familiar with what Bohemia is. We had a little mention of it at the beginning of last semester, but I want to be sure you realize Bohemia was one of the important kingdoms of Europe during the Middle Ages. It had a great university before there was any university in Germany. In fact, the first university in Germany was founded by people who left the University of Prague over some disagreement and went to Germany and started a university at Leipzig. Bohemia was a great and important country through the Middle Ages. And then at about 1400, the daughter of the King of Bohemia had returned to her country after the death of her husband, who was the King of England. And when she had come back in 1400, the people with her had brought copies of the works of John Wycliffe. And these works had been studied extensively by a brilliant Bohemian preacher and scholar named John Huss. And John Huss became a tremendous influence in Bohemia. You remember, those of you who were here last year, that at the Council of Constance in 1415, John Huss went to the council under a safe conduct, but while there he was seized, imprisoned, and eventually burned at the stake, which greatly irritated the people of Bohemia. His closest associate was later treated similarly. But the people of Bohemia stood solidly on the Protestant teaching that John Huss had given. And while the teaching of John Wycliffe practically died out in England, it was continued in Bohemia through the work of John Huss. And so Bohemia, the attempt had been made then by the Romanists to subdue Bohemia, and the best armies of Europe went to attack Bohemia, but the people, filled with zeal for the defense of their faith in God, the peasants came out with agricultural implements and fought some of these troops to a standstill. And others, of course, of their troops that were well armed also fought, and the troops were driven back. And so for 200 years, Bohemia retained its strong Protestant stand. Those of you who were here last semester may remember that we mentioned in connection with Martin Luther that when he was at the debate at Leipzig, when Luther presented his views, somebody said, "Well, you're following views like John Huss." And Luther said, "Well," he says, "I don't know about that, but," he says, "if Huss held these views, Huss isn't as bad as we've all thought he was." And later, Luther studied Huss's and his works and decided Huss actually had not been a great, terrible man like had been taught to everyone in Luther's childhood, but had been one who really knew the gospel. And so Bohemia had the gospel, or at least had the good understanding of the gospel and the strong Protestant stand, a century before Martin Luther, and continued a century after Martin Luther. It was a great Protestant land. Now, it is very sad that this kingdom, one of the finest peoples in all the world, that in Paris, when the people of Paris heard how these peasants with their agricultural implements fought off the armies, and just at that time a group of wandering gypsies entered Paris. And the people in Paris said, oh, look, these must be the wild Bohemians. And so ever since, the name Bohemian is used commonly to mean wild people, when actually they're among the most solid and dependable and sober-minded people in the world, are the Bohemian people, who nowadays, perhaps as in order to avoid this false emphasis that has come to the word Bohemian, are usually spoken of as the Czechs. And their land we speak of today as Czechoslovakia, a land which perhaps has suffered more hardship and misery and mistreatment than almost any country in the world. But Bohemia or Czechoslovakia for 200 years stood as a solid bulwark for Protestantism. It was rather unfortunate that during the 16th century they agreed to take Ferdinand as their king. Ferdinand was by that time quite generally tolerant, and he was fairly tolerant in Austria, where he ruled as Archduke and later became Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. But to take a man like that and give him the power that was given to him, well, who knows what it may mean for the future. And they found that out 70 years later. Because Ferdinand had managed to get his son recognized as his heir as King of Bohemia, and so Maximilian II, who was a man who almost became a Protestant, was Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, Archduke of Austria. He was also King of Bohemia. And then when he was succeeded by his brother Matthew, he was also King of Bohemia, but Matthew was one who had had considerable training by the Jesuits and who was ready to seek any means of destroying Protestantism in Bohemia. And I should mention also here in connection with the Habsburgs, perhaps under this head, although it's really distinct from it, should mention one of the large sections of Germany, the most southern, southeastern section of present-day Germany, which is called Bavaria. And Bavaria had a ruling family, which in later years boasted that it was the only ruling family in any part of Germany or Austria, which was not at some time affected by Protestant teaching. And of course, now by the 1600, the leaders of Bavaria not only continued their strong Romanist stand, but they were affected by the teaching of the Jesuits, which so greatly affected the attitude of the Habsburgs. Now we take a small b, I will name a town on the edge of Bavaria. It is called Donauwörth, you'd call it in German, D-O-N-A-U. D-O-N-A-U, which is German for Daniel. D-O-N-A-U-W, and then in German it would be an O with two dots over it. They often represent it in English by either an I or an E. So I've seen it all three ways. I guess the proper way, you might as well write the German way, W-O with two dots over it, R-T-H. Donauwörth. This was a town, a free city. And as you remember, under the Peace of Augsburg, the free cities were allowed to have whatever religion they wanted, but had to tolerate Roman Catholicism. That is, they could not order the Romanists to emigrate from them, as a Protestant ruler could in his territory. The free city must allow the Roman Catholics freedom. But the majority of the city, if they were Romanists, perhaps might expel the Protestants. If they were Protestants, they could control most everything, but they had to allow a certain liberty to the Romans. Yes?
You said this is near the border of Bavaria, inside or outside?
It's in, well, it is in the border of present-day Bavaria. But at that time, it was considered one of the free cities of the empire. There are no free cities anymore. It's part of Bavaria today. But in those days, there were many cities in the empire which were responsible only to the emperor. Most of the great cities were that way. The cities had gained their freedom. They were great centers of commerce, centers of trade, centers of skilled artisans, And they were not under the particular dukes and leaders. Most of the cities of it, of course. And Donauwert was one of such cities. It was right on the edge of Bavaria. It's in the territory that today is Bavaria. Well, now in Donauwert, under the agitation or the quiet pressure of the Jesuits, I mean, the Jesuits were not arousing big campaigns and making public attacks on the Protestants, but they were privately in their schools, in their churches, and in their dealings with the Romanists, urging them on to take strong measures against the Protestants. In Donauwert, there was a monastery which had the habit of having a march through the city once a year. And this march had been conducted carrying the emblems of their religion in a quiet way for the previous 60 years. Nobody paid much attention to it except the Roman Catholics. But now they began to have more of these parades through the city, and they began to have banners declaring the wickedness of Protestantism and holding up emblems of worship of the saints and the Virgin Mary and so on. And some of the young Protestants, seeing the development, the change that was coming, became excited, and some of them began to yell slogans against them and even to throw some things at them. And when there came this movement, the city was probably three-fourths Protestant or more. But when this happened, the Romanists there appealed to the emperor. This was in 1607. And the emperor, Matthias, or Matthew, it is sometimes written as Matthew in Anglicized form, sometimes Matthias in the form that he usually used, the emperor ordered that the city of Donauwert be placed under the ban of the empire, and that the king of the Duke of Bavaria be authorized to seize the city and to destroy Protestantism within. And so the city of Donauwert was seized. Protestant services were altogether stopped in it. The people ordered to attend Romanist services or to leave the city, giving up all their possessions, all their property, and fleeing as refugees. And this, naturally, this is not considered part of the 30 Years' War, 10 years before it began. But it showed what was happening, and it aroused considerable excitement throughout Europe. Yes? 1607. And the excitement which was aroused by this was particularly among the Calvinists, which would be natural because the Calvinists were more in southern Germany, and northern Germany seemed a long ways away. And in addition to that, the Lutherans of northern Germany knew that according to the Peace of Augsburg, they were guaranteed safety in the maintenance of their religion, while that did not extend to the Calvinists. And consequently, the Calvinists in southern and southwestern Europe began to say, this is something that has not been done since the Peace of Augsburg. There's been no such arbitrary, high-handed seizure of a Protestant city and forcible changing of it into a Roman Catholic city. If they proceeded now to the place where they do that, what will they be doing against the rest of them? And so they tried to get the dukes and leaders in different cities of Germany and also rulers elsewhere who believed in the gospel to form a union for defense. They called it the Evangelical Union. And in Germany today, the word evangelical or evangelisch is used for Protestants. It is a common term in Prussia today. Everyone had to say, what are you, evangelisch or katholisch? The common term. So when you say evangelical union, they meant Protestant, actually. But they formed an evangelical union, and they tried to get the Lutheran princes in North Germany to join with them, and they refused. They said, we don't care what happens to you Calvinists. We're not even sure you're Christians. But they said, anyway, they said, we are protected by the Peace of Augsburg. We have nothing to fear, and we are not particularly interested in trying to help you, and they refused to join. In England, there were those who tried to get the king to join with it, and he refused. He said, we are not part of the politics of the continent. He kept out of it. But the great bulk of the English gave their sympathy to it. And as soon as this was formed, the Romanist princes formed a Catholic League. A Catholic League in opposition to it. Well, now this is leading up to the outbreak of the war. But in we will go on now to its actual outbreak, small c, Bohemia. I've mentioned to you, reminded you a little of the background of Bohemia. Now, Bohemia saw that Ferdinand, who was the Archduke of Austria, was next in line to become the King of Bohemia. And Ferdinand was moving bitterly against Protestantism. And Bohemia was perhaps 99 or 100% Protestant. And so the people said, we do not want Ferdinand for our king. Ferdinand said that Bohemia had been for centuries an elective monarchy. But it was customary to elect the next man in line of hereditary descent. And Frederick had that hereditary claim. Frederick said, I am entitled to be king of Bohemia. And he sent representatives to them. And it demanded that he have this position. And then some books say they followed the old Bohemian custom of defenestration, which means they threw the representatives out the window to show their feeling toward him. Mr. A.G.? Ferdinand. Thank you. Ferdinand. Thank you. I get the two names mixed quite frequently. They both start with F after all. But this is Ferdinand. We will have a Frederick in a minute. So it's very important we keep it straight. Thank you. This is Ferdinand, who was the Archduke of Austria. And then the people, the nobles of Bohemia said, we are thoroughly Protestant. We should have a Protestant ruler. There is a place in Germany which, why should we get the Archduke of Austria, who is a Romanist, even though 80% of the people of Austria are Protestants? We should get a man who is a Protestant ruler. And there is Heidelberg, where the Heidelberg Catechism was made. And it has a duke who is one of the electors of the empire named Frederick. Here's where Frederick comes in. A little ahead using the name, well, not the material. Frederick, the Duke at Heidelberg, where the Heidelberg Catechism came from, a strongly Calvinistic area, and his wife was the daughter of King James I of England. And they said, here is a strongly Protestant nation, England, whose king's daughter is the wife of this man, and this man himself is the leader of a strongly Calvinistic area. He would be the titular king of our country to give the sort of government we want. And so they invited Frederick to become king of Bohemia. And Frederick accepted. And ever since, he is known in history as the Winter King. He's called the Winter King because he only remained king one winter. But that's the term that they came to give to him in history. Frederick went to Bohemia and was welcomed as the king of Bohemia, and the kingdom continued exactly as it had been because its people were practically all Protestants and very ardent Protestants. But Ferdinand raised an army and attacked, and in a number of battles the Bohemians defeated him. But then in a great battle, which they called the Battle of White Mountain, Ferdinand had a decisive victory. And as a result of the victory, Frederick fled. Frederick fled from Bohemia. Ferdinand took over. Half of the leading Bohemian nobles were executed. He brought in his force to take over complete possession of the country. Many of the Protestants fled the land. Thousands of others were killed. As a result of this war that lasted 2 or 3 years, the population of Bohemia, which had been 4 million, was reduced to 1 million. How many of the 3 million were killed and how many escaped, we don't know. But it was a tremendous decrease in the population of Bohemia. And then all the churches were turned over to the Romanists. The Jesuits took over complete direction of the religious life of the country. It was made a capital crime to have a copy of the Bible in your possession in the Bohemian language. The people were forced to either become Romanists. Many managed to flee. Many others were killed. The nation became almost entirely Romans. So that is 1 million survivors out of the 4 million. And there were, however, thousands of people who managed to hide their Hussite Bibles and bring them out secretly from time to time and read them with their family. We don't know how many thousands, but when about 250 years later, an Austrian emperor proclaimed toleration of religion throughout his domains, there were a very sizable number of these brought out. And when Jan Masaryk, the foreign minister of Bohemia, after the people were foolish enough in 1940, was it, or 46, I guess, to agree to a coalition government, so-called, which enabled the communists to get control of the secret police, when he saw that the Czech liberties were again about to be destroyed, he was reading his Czechish Bible, his Hussite Bible, passed on in his family through all those years, when the men came who seized him and threw him out the window and thus killed him and instituted complete communist control over Czechoslovakia in, I believe it was either 46 or 48. But the destruction of Protestantism in Bohemia by Ferdinand's troops was one of the most complete destructions that it has seen in any country. After World War I, both Czechoslovakia was restored for the first time in 300 years. 250 years. First time it was restored to be a, I guess it was 300, to be an independent country. I was through there about 1927, and you felt as if you were in a place that had just awakened from sleep. Everywhere there was people were happy, they were celebrating, they were putting up new buildings, they named a railroad station after President Wilson of the United States, who had much to do with their being given their freedom, and it just seemed like a country that had awakened again. And then, after World War I, they say, I heard a man talk who told of Czechish background who lived in Pittsburgh, he went over there, he said, if you talk to somebody in the train about politics, they said, oh, we've been hearing too much about politics. You talk to them about world conditions, oh, we don't know what's going to happen, world conditions. But you start talking about religion, and the people were intensely interested. One day he went in the park and started to hold a street meeting, and in a few minutes he had 3,000 people gathered. In the 20s, it was one of the greatest evangelistic opportunities anywhere in the world. In fact, I was so stirred by it at that time that if I had completed my education then, I would have gone to there to give my life to the work in Czechoslovakia. As it was, I had several years of education yet and was not ready to make a decision like that. Of course, now there's no possibility for them to cross. Czechoslovakia was overwhelmed by the Nazis, and then now, when again they thought they had their freedom, the communists have now subjected them. But now we go on to small d, the Palatinate. P-A-L-A-T-I-N-A-T-E. Yes? P-A-L-A-T-I-N-A-T-E. Palatinate. Now the Palatinate, I don't know why it's called that, but it is a section of Germany, a section of which Heidelberg was the capital. And naturally, Frederick of Heidelberg, being one of the leaders of the Calvinists of Germany, and also being the man who had taken the kingship of Czechoslovakia and thus came into direct confrontation with Ferdinand II, the Spanish troops, you know, Spain was also under the Habsburgs because Charles V's son, Philip II, perhaps the most fanatical Romanist ruler in all history, the one who sent the armada against England, he had been king of Spain, and now it was his descendants, and they still were getting great amounts of gold from the New World, which gave them much resource with which to hire soldiers the Spanish troops now marched north and east and came up the Rhine into the region around Heidelberg. And they seized and destroyed the property of the king in Heidelberg there, destroyed the greater part of the town, and the Jesuits took over everything and declared Protestantism absolutely forbidden in the whole region. And Ferdinand ordered that the position of one of the electors who would elect the emperor, which had belonged to the king, to the Duke of Heidelberg, should be transferred to the Duke of Bavaria. So they transferred this to the Duke of Bavaria. They took this whole area completely under their power at the beginning of the 30 Years' War, thus. And only the forces as they came in gave one particular order to their soldiers. You may destroy what you feel like, you may pillage and plunder and burn, but one thing you must try to do. Go into the University of Heidelberg, which had been in existence now for nearly a century. Go into the University of Heidelberg with great care and get its precious library. It had a great library of manuscripts, one of the greatest in Europe. And so they got the Heidelberg library, being careful that it wouldn't be burned. And they took this library and sent it to Rome as a present to the Pope, where it formed one of the great treasures of the Vatican library. And when I was in Germany in 1927, I read in a guidebook for this region of Germany that when they had the 400th anniversary of the University of Heidelberg, the Pope sent a letter to them telling them of his great interest in them and of his congratulations on their successful completion of 400 years of leadership in scholarship. And as a sign of his interest in them, he sent them a catalog of the manuscripts in the Heidelberg Library, which still remain as a portion of the Vatican Library in Rome. So they have the nice catalog now. So if you want to see the manuscripts, you go to Rome. So this is what happened to the Palatinate, but the difference is, what happened to Bohemia continued for centuries, and Protestantism was illegal and impossible in Bohemia thereafter. While in the Palatinate, it was right in the heart of the region of the 30 Years' War and went through many changes before its final status was settled. So we go on to look briefly at small East Switzerland. And we look now only at the section of Switzerland which is nearest to Austria. The section, I believe it is, where St. Moritz is, one of the most famous ski resorts in Switzerland. Today, you'll often see the name of it in the paper in connection with great things that happened there at St. Moritz, but there's a large area there which they usually refer to by the name the Grisons, G-R-I-S-O-N-S. I don't know why they make it plural. The German word that the Swiss guidebooks have is Graubünden for it, but the region actually is one where they don't speak either French or German. Most of the people in a large part of Graubünden speak a language derived from Latin called either Ladinisch or Romanisch. It's a language different from the other languages of Switzerland. But this was a section which was maybe 9/10 Protestant. And at this time, in 1620, a concerted plan was made, and the Romanist people in Grisons attacked the Protestants in the middle of the night and killed men, women, and children. And the forces from Austria came in and took it over and made it entirely Romanist. And I believe it's largely so to this day. Now, these were the events which were starting the 30 Years' War, so-called. And the armies now of Bavaria and of the King of Austria, who was Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, proceeded to attack the Protestant regions of Germany, particularly the Calvinistic regions, to attack them and captured many of them. And they were able in 1629 to make the emperor was able to make an edict which seemed to end things. This is small f, the edict of restitution. And the edict of restitution, which I believe was 1629, declared that everything that the Protestants had taken, which had belonged to the church previous to the Reformation, must be restored in any part of Germany. At least anything they had taken after 1552, when the Peace of Passau had been made. Anything since 1552. Well, now this would involve two archbishoprics, a dozen or more bishoprics, many monasteries, and great amounts of a great part of Germany, including many things in North Germany, which was under thoroughly Lutheran control. And the Lutheran leaders there, who had previously refused to help, now saw that as far as the Roman is concerned, they were exactly the same position as the Calvinists. And they saw that if this edict of restitution was carried through, there would be great Romanist centers right in the middle of their areas, which were 100% Protestant. And they saw what had been done in other areas where there were such small sections from which the attacks had been made. And some of them perhaps wished they had started, joined in the first place to help the Duke of Heidelberg and the people of Bohemia. And many of the English people said, why didn't James send a sizable force to help his son-in-law? All he said was ambassadors to tell him of his regards and his interests, but he refused to send help because he was trying to get his son married to a Spanish princess. And so they, it looks now in 1629 as if Protestantism would be entirely destroyed throughout Germany. Well, then we go on to G, which I will call Gustavus Adolphus. Gustavus Adolphus. You remember, those of you here last semester, as practically everybody, I believe, remembers that Gustavus Vasa was the man who won the freedom of Sweden and who made Sweden Protestant. That is, he did not himself advance Protestantism directly. He gave free reign and tolerance to the Protestant preachers. And when the Romanists declared that this must stop, he abdicated the throne rather than submit to them. And realizing how tremendously important he was to Sweden, they submitted. And then he proceeded, whenever a monastery was less than half full, he would unite it with another one and take over its property. And he, whenever a bishopric was vacant, he would appoint a Protestant. And so the Swedish church, without any sharp, sudden change, was turned over completely to Protestant leadership. And it became, for about three centuries, one of the most Protestant, most Christian countries in all of Europe. Unfortunately, it is one in which modernism has moved perhaps as fast as any country in the world in recent years. But in Sweden, the Jesuits had made a great attempt to win the country back and had not succeeded, but had succeeded in winning the wife of one of the kings. And the son of Gustavus Vasa, and she had raised her son to favor Roman Catholicism. And this son of hers became king of Poland and had much to do with helping to destroy Protestantism in Poland. He was also king of Sweden, but the Swedes rose against him and refused to allow him to do what he wanted in Sweden. So they had a king, Charles of Sweden, son of Gustavus Vasa, who was a strong Protestant, and Gustavus Adolphus was his son. Now Gustavus Adolphus saw what was happening in Germany, and he saw that in Germany here was the probability of the destruction of Christianity, except for the superstition of the Middle Ages, of course. Yes? Exactly. Grandson of Gustavus Vasa. Thank you. And so Gustavus Adolphus had certain difficulties with Poland at the time, a continuation of the situation under his father. And he felt that if he could get himself freed from these difficulties with Poland, he should step in and try to help the beleaguered German Protestants. And Richelieu, the French, the cardinal who was in control of France at the time, as you remember, Richelieu, though a Roman Catholic cardinal, was more interested in making France great than in advancing Romanism. And he feared the great power the emperor was getting with these conquests. And so he sent a messenger to Gustavus Vasa, and he said, I will give you financial help if you care to intervene in German affairs. It was a very helpful thing to Gustavus. Gustavus might have done it without it, but with this help, he marched with an army of earnest Lutherans from Sweden into Germany and attacked the forces of the emperor, which had most of Germany in their hands now, and drove them back. The Saxon kingdom of northern Germany started in to help him the best they could, but their soldiers were not trained. They were at a great disadvantage at this stage. They probably would have been completely destroyed if it were not for Gustavus Adolphus' forces, which would march into battle singing Luther's hymns, and which felt that they were fighting for the preservation of what Luther had stood for in Germany. And so, in a series of battles, Gustavus marched through much of Germany, winning it back from the emperor's forces. However, in 1632, after about 2 years of vigorous fighting, in a great battle at Lützen, which he won, he himself was killed. But his representatives continued the war, and the result was that the complete destruction, which had seemed certain, did not take place. For a time, the Swedes were, it looked as if they might be completely victorious. They were not, but they were sufficiently victorious to drive back the forces of the emperor and to prevent them from completely overrunning Central Europe. Now I will call H continued war, because between 1632 and 1648, there was very little change in the actual political situation. The Romanists fought constantly to win complete control. The Protestants fought constantly to protect themselves from it. And one side would win for a time, and the other side would win for a time. And for 16 more years, the war continued with comparatively little change. Richelieu, if he thought the Protestants were going to be wiped out, would send a small army from France to attack the emperor's force in the rear, because he didn't want the Habsburgs to get too strong. Whether this was a decisive force or not, I don't know. But he gave considerable financial help also in to the forces against the emperor. Eventually, in 1648, all the people on both sides were so utterly exhausted and so utterly tired of the war that they agreed to make peace. And so J is the Treaty of Westphalia, 1648. The Treaty of Westphalia. And this Treaty of Westphalia in 1648, politically, was tremendously important in history, because it weakened Germany to a position from which it failed to develop as France and England and some other countries developed into modern nations until centuries later. It was impossible under the conditions of the Treaty of Westphalia. The treaty divided Germany into about 100 parts, a few of them fairly large, many of them very small, which were practically independent, owing a nominal subservience to the emperor. These Habsburgs continued to rule as emperors and had complete control in their own hereditary domains, which included Austria and Bohemia. But the claim of the order which had been given in the Edict of Restitution, that all property that had ever belonged to the church previously that the Protestants now had, that had been taken by Protestants since 1552, must be given to the Romanists, was abrogated. And instead of that, there was substituted the year 1624. And so anything the Protestants had taken since 1624 was given back to the Romans. But anything that had turned Protestant between 1552 and 1624, they retained. And the descendants of the Duke of the Palatinate were reestablished in Heidelberg. The Duke of Bavaria had the electorate and didn't want to give it up, and so they agreed to make an eighth electorate. So the electorate that previously belonged to the Palatinate, Bavaria had, but the Duke of the Palatinate became an eighth electorate. Instead of having seven electors, there were now eight. That still left the Romans in majority, but not in the overwhelming majority they had before. Yes? Well, now, this doesn't refer to things captured in war, but to, for instance, a big church of an area which had been thoroughly, which the people had been considered to be Romanist, but in which the people had come to believe in Lutheran or Calvinistic teachings, and they used the church for Protestant service. Now they could keep it. Now, there were very few changes of that kind after 1624, very few. But between 1552 and 1610, there had been a great many. And those were the ones that really amounted. But if there were any since 1624, they had to give it up. And the regions which the Romanists had overrun, like the Palatinate and so on, they were given back. But the regions which the emperor claimed were his own private property, like Austria and Bohemia, them he kept and destroyed Protestantism out of. Probably three-fourths of the people of Austria had been Protestant. Now Protestantism is absolutely forbidden in Austria. And probably 98% or 100% in Bohemia had been. Now there were none in Bohemia, at least none open. It was absolutely forbidden. But those, they were not, the emperor was not interfered with in those territories. Those, he said, were his territories, and he did what he wanted. But the treaty made one new concession. That instead of now Romanism and Lutheranism being the only two permitted religions, now there were three: Romanism, Lutheranism, and Calvinism. Calvinism was given a standing equal to that of Lutheranism. Now, number four, the results of the 30 Years' War. Number three was the 30 Years' War itself. Number four, the results of it. Small a, the Protestantism was destroyed by force in Austria, Bohemia, and Bavaria. In Austria, Bohemia, and Bohemia, it was destroyed by force. It was also done in Bavaria, where the Duke had always been Romanist, but great multitudes of people had been Protestant. Now Protestantism, he could easily wipe out of his territory, since he didn't have Bohemia on one side and Austria on another, in which there were great Protestant groups. He was now had strong Romanist control on both those sides, and he could proceed to make the same change in Bavaria. So for the next 250 years, there was hardly any time when there was any Protestant preaching permitted in either Austria, Bohemia, or Bavaria. Then number B, the Northern Netherlands were freed from the danger of Spanish reconquest. The Northern Netherlands. You remember the Netherlands had been what is now Germany and, I mean, Holland and Belgium and the northern part of France. That had been the Netherlands. And what is today Belgium had been one of the greatest Protestant sections in Europe. Not completely Protestant, but a tremendous Protestant area. Two Augustinian monks in Antwerp had been the first martyrs of the Protestant Reformation. Well, Philip II, son of Charles V, had for 30 years sent great Spanish armies up there to completely subdue this territory. And the southern half of it, they eventually gained control. With the result that in what is now Belgium, which had been one of the great Protestant sections of Europe, not completely Protestant at all, but a great Protestant center. In that area, Protestantism was completely wiped out. Many of the people were destroyed, many were forced to become Romanists, Then he fled to the northern section. The northern part of it, which is now Holland. In 1609, a truce was made between Spain and the northern part of it. A truce to last for 12 years. That ended in 1621. Some of you may know the date 1621 in connection with Americans. But 1621 is the date in which the emperor got complete control of Bohemia and killed half of the nobles of Czechoslovakia. But in 1621, the truce ended and the war broke out again, and the Spanish troops tried to get possession of the northern land that was coming into it from what is now Belgium. But the war, the 30 Years' War, ended without their having succeeded in doing so. And so at the end of the war, of the 30 Years' War, they were recognized as an independent country. Well, now in this country, the great attacks of the Spanish and their tremendously extreme measures of destruction of Protestantism had resulted in all the people of the Netherlands being roused against the Spanish tyranny. And the result was that alongside the Calvinists of the Netherlands, who fought so valiantly against the Spanish, there were Roman Catholics who did not share their religious feeling, but who were equally interested in freedom from Spanish domination. And so in Belgium, the majority had been Protestant, but they were either killed or wiped out, or forced to become Romanists and their children to never hear anything about Protestants. In the northern part, in Holland, they gave toleration to all their people. So that it was the first nation of any size to have real toleration of religion. And it became a great place for English who didn't agree with the Church of England to flee to and establish little churches in Holland. So in Holland, there continued maybe a third of the people to be Roman Catholic. And with the nation Calvinist, and by law the king was supposed to be a Calvinist in Holland. With that situation, the third or so of the people that are Romanists have continued to be very, very ardent Romanists during most of the century since. While in Bavaria, where everybody was a Romanist, the general attitude was, oh yes, of course we're Romanists. That's that. With very little real interest in either Bavaria or Austria among the people in the last two centuries, in whether they were Romanists or not, except that governmental Protestantism was forbidden to come in. But in Holland, there was an energetic, earnest group of very pious Romanists, which continued up till recently. Just now, that group is one of the most radical groups in the Roman Church, as some of you may have read. The full details of it, I don't know, but they've been very much in the paper in recent days. That was the number two here under the results of it, or B, I called it, the Northern Netherlands. A small c, Calvinism recognized as entitled to exist. That we've already mentioned, I just mentioned again here. And then small d, Germany desolated beyond description. I have here a history by a professor in Princeton University published a few years ago, History of the Modern World. I'm just going to read to you the chapter in which he, or a paragraph in which he describes the effects in Germany. He says, physically, Germany was wrecked by the 30 Years' War. Cities were sacked by mercenary soldiers with a rapacity that their commanders could not control, or the commanders themselves, drawing no supplies from their home governments, systematically looted whole areas to maintain their army. Magdeburg was besieged 10 times, Leipzig 5. In one woolen town of Bohemia with a population of 6,000 before the wars, the citizens fled and disappeared, the houses collapsed, and 8 years after the peace, only 850 people were found there. On the site of another small town, Swedish cavalry found nothing but wolves. The peasants murdered, put to flight, or tortured by soldiers to reveal their few valuables, ceased to give attention to farming. Agriculture was ruined, so that starvation followed, and with it came pestilence. Even revised modern estimates allow that in many extensive parts of Germany, as many as a third of the population may have perished. 50 years ago, they would have said two-thirds. At least it was tremendous. He says even revised estimates still say at least a third. The effect of fire, disease, undernourishment, homelessness, and exposure in the 17th century were the more terrible because of the lack of means to combat them. People lived in piles of debris and ransacked dumps to find food, as they did after the Second World War. But even the Second World War, in sheer depopulation, was not as devastating for Germany as was the 30 Years' War. This is a brief summary of the what was perhaps as destructive a war as the world has ever seen. And the last 16 years of it made practically no change. But the war made a tremendous change, mostly what happened the first 4 years. The utter destruction of Protestantism in Austria and in Bohemia and in Bavaria. The similar destruction in the Palatinate and some other sections was reversed and did not continue. And Protestantism was now made safe in the rest of Germany. And so from this time on, in the Calvinistic section and in the Lutheran section, there developed among the great mass of the people a great interest in the gospel, a great interest in the Bible, a piety, a character that was of a very high level until within the last few years. But the nation was divided up into so many little sections that while it greatly stimulated many people, as the little dukes of the different little areas vied among themselves to have the greatest court in the area and so on, yet it prevented the development of Germany into a real nation until 1870, and it held Germany way back behind the other countries of the world. Now this situation that established in the 30 Years' War, it meant that for another century, Germany was in a pretty bad situation. It took a full century to recover from the effects of this terrible devastation. We will turn then next Wednesday, week from today, we will turn back to England and see what was happening in England during the last part of this, during the middle third of the century, a period of a few years that is as important in the history of the Christian Church as anything that has ever happened anywhere. We'll continue there next time.